Welcome to the Infrastructure Show. I'm your host, Professor Joseph Schoffer, and I'm the director of Northwestern University's Infrastructure Technology Institute.
And I'm your co-host, Tom Herman.
The Infrastructure Show is designed to present to listeners the reality of America's infrastructure, its condition, why it is the way it is, and what can be done about it.
Panama Canal, begun in 1879 by the French and ultimately completed by the United States between 1904 and 1914, is a 48-mile-long ship canal that crosses the country of Panama, allowing ships to travel between the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans. The construction of the canal was an immensely difficult and dangerous project, during which more than 22,000 workers died, primarily from malaria and yellow fever.
Today, the canal is a key component of the global logistics system, carrying about 15,000 ships each year. The 1 millionth ship transited the canal in October of 2010. As an example of a large-scale infrastructure project, the Panama Canal is particularly impressive because it has performed effectively for nearly 100 years. To accommodate the largest ships today, the Panama Canal Authority has embarked on an ambitious expansion program scheduled to deliver larger locks and deeper channels by 2014.
Professor Schoffer has just returned from a trip through the canal, and today he'll share with me a description of the canal's features, his thoughts on the canal's current condition, and a look at challenges for the future. Welcome, Professor.
Thank you.
Question number one of the Panama Canal, what is it and where is it?
Well, the Panama Canal, as we said, connects the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans, basically starts on the north in the Caribbean Sea and goes south or southeast to the Pacific. So it's a little bit, the geography is a little bit different than people expect because it doesn't actually go from east to west, but it goes from north to south because of the orientation of the isthmus of Panama.
And it says that the French started it in 1879. Why'd they start it? What made them want to do it?
Well, the French were interested in the money. They thought that this was a money-making project. It was really pushed by Ferdinand de Lesseps, who was the entrepreneur who organized and the construction of the Suez Canal, which was a very different problem 20 or so years prior to the Panama Canal. And he really believed that he was the master canal builder of the world and that he could pull off this job in Panama. He developed that belief sitting in France and not really understanding what the challenges were in Panama.
And if we're talking about 1879 construction, is that bunch of guys with shovels?
No, actually, the world was further developed than that at that point. So railroads were in business, and there was a railroad that crossed the Isthmus of Panama, I think, in 1855. And it turns out that was a particularly desirable route because in the early days of the gold rush, going by sea to the railroad that crossed the Isthmus of Panama and then by sea up to California was the fastest, safest way to get from the East Coast to the West Coast of the United States. You may remember that the Transcontinental Railroad in the United States was not connected until 1869.
So if you're going to dig a canal like that across a relatively narrow strip of land, at least compared to the width of a continent, do you start in the middle and go out so you keep the water out until you get to the edges?
Well, that's a useful point that you make. Keeping the water out is kind of important if you're using a dry excavation technology, which the French used and the United States used to great advantage, and that is what are still called steam shovels. In fact, the construction was started at multiple points, and the points were connected. And some of the construction was dry construction with shovels, and some of it was wet constructions, underwater constructions with dredges. And in some cases, the project was started with dry construction and shovels, and water was admitted to that section. Slides resulted in a filling in that section, and they rebuilt it, redug it out with dredges. So this is really a mix of technologies that was used now, and in fact, the same mix of technologies that are used today.
And how did the United States come to take over the project, or did they become a partner?
It's a complicated political history, and what I normally say to people is I'm an engineer and I don't have to know the dates or the politics, but the fact is that the project was pushed by then President Teddy Roosevelt. It was motivated by a really strong strategic desire to connect the two oceans. The real pressure rose at the time in 1898, I believe it was, in the Spanish-American War, when the battleship Maine exploded in Havana Harbor, the causes of which are, I think, still under debate. And the United States dispatched a military ship, the USS Oregon, from the Seattle area and ultimately from San Francisco to go to Havana. And I believe that trip took 87 days. And it became really clear that the United States had to have a Navy in every ocean, or there needed to be a way to move the strategic resources very quickly across there. And Roosevelt pushed the project. The history is complicated, but fundamentally, the land was owned by Columbia, and through a variety of tricks, ended up in the United States' hand, and we effectively bought the rights to build the canal from the French, who at that point in time were bankrupt and were really looking for money.
So you were down there how long ago now?
About 2 weeks ago.
Just 2 weeks ago. And what inspired your trip?
My trip was inspired because by the fact that I led a university alumni travel group on a cruise through the canal, and the crew, the travelers who went with us were interested in a vacation, and I was really interested in seeing the Panama Canal again. And it's a unique experience, particularly for me as an engineer and as a researcher, to see a piece of infrastructure that's, on the one hand, 100 years old, and the other hand, a critical element of the global logistics system today.
Now, it's 48 miles long, is that correct?
48 miles long.
So on a cruise of that, do you just go really slowly? How long does the cruise?
You go very slowly because the canal is not particularly wide. It's less than 1,000 feet wide at some points. And there is a series of locks that one must go through to transit the canal, because the canal is basically 85 feet above sea level, so the ships have to climb up through a series of three locks, plus 85 feet, and down at the other side, 85 feet. And the locking process is a slow process. In each case, there are three lock steps up and three lock steps down, and each takes 30 to 60 minutes. So canal transit is order magnitude 10 hours.
Mm-hmm. And did you have a chance to speak to people there while you were there who were working on the canal?
Or no, and in fact, it was the other way around, that my task was to learn something about the canal and speak to my travelers about what was going on. So it was an opportunity for me, and this is a trip I've made several times before, it was an opportunity for me to learn about the technological history of the canal, which I think is particularly interesting, and also to learn about plans for modernization of the canal.
So we'll get to the modernization in a little bit, but what are the most technologically interesting aspects?
Well, the most interesting problem from my perspective was developing a design for the canal. And the French really struggled because they were very much committed to a sea level canal, which would have meant digging out the earth not only to sea level, but to 40 feet below sea level to accommodate the depth of ships. And de Lesseps, as the French entrepreneur who led their effort, had built had organized the construction of the Suez Canal, which was a sea level canal, in very much different terrain with a very different labor setting. There was a lot of forced labor involved in construction of the Suez Canal. And he was absolutely committed to the notion that a sea level canal was the only way to do this job. The breakthrough was to realize that a lock canal could be built in a fraction of the time at a fraction of the cost, because the amount of excavation necessary was very much less. And the resistance came from the concerns that locks would take a long time for transit, they would be vulnerable, and they would be expensive. It turns out that there was, at that point in time, a large amount of experience around the globe, but particularly in the United States, with the design, construction, and operation of locks. And once we once the designers got past that notion, that obstacle, that difference between sea level and a lock canal or a high level canal, the construction became much easier and the operation became much easier. So in effect, what happened? Way to think about locks and trans transiting something like the Isthmus of Panama, which, if you think about it, is really the continental divide. It's just a different part of the continent. So it's a very high part of the continent where the tops of the mountains are in order of magnitude about 400 feet above sea level. The trick to the to designing a lock canal was to build a dam across a very large volume river and collect the water behind the dam, which raised the surface of the path of transit 85 feet above sea level, and by virtue of creating a very large lake behind this dam, created at the same time a 23.5-mile water passage across the Isthmus of Panama. So you start out with about a 48 or 50-mile journey to make, and then by virtue of building one dam, create a 23.5-mile waterway, and the rest is excavation. And the worst part of it was the excavation through the peak of the continental divide, the Culebra Cut, it was called. And that was very difficult, but it was at the same time a very routine, just large scale, but very routine excavation process.
And another difficulty that we mentioned in the opening was the difficulty with disease. How did the United States tackle that and make it livable in the process of
doing
that?
Well, that's another interesting problem, because just as if you look at the decision, but the struggling of the decision to between a lock canal and a sea level canal, there was a struggle with the problem of disease, because it was hard for people to understand the cause of disease. So when we looked at the literature, what we found was that in the middle 1850s, researchers were pointing the finger at mosquitoes as the carriers for diseases like malaria and yellow fever. But it took until about 1905 for this growing literature and experience that pointed in that direction to be accepted by the managers of the construction of the Panama Canal, at which point construction was literally stopped. And all resources were devoted to fighting mosquitoes. And what did that mean? It meant draining standing water. It meant covering standing water with oil or insecticides. It required providing clean piped potable water so that people didn't collect rainwater in cisterns and thereby gave mosquitoes an opportunity to breed. And in less than a year, they basically knocked out the two kinds of mosquitoes that cause separately yellow fever and malaria, made the area of the canal construction safe from disease. They took the disease rate essentially down to zero, and then devoted resources to creating a living and a working environment with housing and recreational resources, and so that in the middle of the construction period, the Panama Canal was the best location for construction workers and for engineers to work. The money was good, the environment was safe, the entertainment was positive, and it drew a lot of people there, a lot of workers there, and in fact, drew a lot of tourists there who came from the United States to what used to be a deadly area because of the disease. They drew tourists there to watch the construction of the canal.
And did it have an immediate impact on international trade and the United States military operations once it was completed?
It did, because one of the things it did was allow us to deploy what was at that point in time a single navy that could move between the seas. And it carried over 100 years a growing flow, a logistics flow particularly between areas in the Pacific, Asia, and the United States. And it's doing that today. So it is a primary route for moving, for example, consumer goods manufactured in Asia to the Gulf Coast and the East Coast of the United States. It's the most economical way. It's not the fastest. The fastest is to move product by sea to the West Coast and pull it by train to the Midwest and the East. But it's less expensive right now to operate through the Panama Canal.
And at the time that it was completed, who owned it, who operated it?
We owned it. The United States owned it, and we operated it until I think it was 1999 when we gave the canal back to the nation of Panama. That was a politically controversial decision, but the historic facts are very clear that the arrangement by which we secured access to and control of the canal were at the margins of international law.
And those people who objected to it passing back to Panama, what were their concerns?
I think one of the worries was that the nation of Panama wouldn't know how to operate this canal and it would fall apart. And exactly the opposite has turned out to be the case. That is, the Panama Canal is operated in a very professional, very high-quality way. The nation of Panama is well aware that the funds that are generated by the tolls on the canal are very important to their economy. The Canal Authority works very closely with the international logistics community, so they're a part of that community. They realize that the markets are important, service quality is important, and they've done a really superior job.
What are the primary markets that it serves now in its modern form, what type of shipping?
Pretty much the primary flow is east and south, east coast of the United States to China, back and forth, and yeah, there has to be flow in both directions, even if the bulk of consumer products move from Asia to the United States. Empty containers move in the other direction. Food products move in the other direction. And scrap metal moves in the other direction. So there's certainly an equivalent flow or the ships would pile up at one end. The two primary markets that, in terms of product that the canal carries are container ships, which are largely consumer goods, and dry bulk, which is largely grain, but it could also be coal. There's some tanker traffic as well, but the canal is not large enough and really never will be large enough to move crude carriers the kind you see in the Middle East.
Now, some people have referred to or mentioned the canal as being a bottleneck and this being a problem. What is the problem and what's
the canal's a bottleneck today because the size of ships has grown significantly over the past few decades. And what's driving that is scale economies. That is, it's cheaper to move a lot of product in a single ship, if it's a big ship, with a small crew. And the typical product, as we said, is a manufactured product in containers. The way we measure containers is by the size. So we talk about a TEU, which means a 20-foot equivalent unit. It's a container, kind of container you see on loading docks, on railroad trains, freight trains, and on trucks almost anywhere you go in the world. So it's a container that's 20 feet long, 8 feet wide, and 8.5 feet wide. That's called a TEU. The typical container ship carry 2,500 to 3,000 TEUs. The largest container ships that are being made today carry 11,000 TEUs. And you carry 11,000 TEUs with a crew of 12 or 13 people. Starts to be very inexpensive to move that product. The problem is big ships are wide ships, and wide ships don't go through the Panama Canal because the narrowest point on the canal is the locks, and the locks are 110 feet wide. So that we have a lock that's 110 feet wide. If you think about it, what the Canal Authority will do is they'll accept a ship that's about 107 feet wide. So that means you have 18-inch clearance on each side, and 18-inch clearance going through a lock is really not a problem. It works fine, but you haven't got any room to grow. And the newest ships are considerably larger than that.
Now, at 18 inches on each side, ships got to be bumping through there.
It doesn't bump. The ships don't bump, and so if you've seen pictures of the Panama Canal, ships move through the locks attached to a set of what they call mules or towing locomotives, an equal number on each side of the ship that are attached to the ship by steel cables. The locomotives do not tow the ship. The ship moves under its own power. The locomotives only serve to keep the ship centered and avoid bumping the edges of the canal.
Like a rail for a train.
Like a rail, exactly what a good way to think about it. But the ship's in the water, so it can float side to side. So you attach it by steel cables to some locomotives on the side that ride right alongside the ship and prevent it from striking. So it's not that it can't; it's that it doesn't strike the side.
And is the Canal Authority looking at any options for?
Well, the Canal Authority's done a couple of things. One of the things they've done is they've changed the pricing. And they've priced by on the basis of service. So it used to be that the tolls were flat tolls for ships, and now they're a function of the type of ship, the size of the ship, and the kinds of products that the ship carries. So it's kind of value-based pricing. The Canal Authority has been very wise at understanding what the value of its services are, and it charges on the basis of that value. And it charges in a very clever way in that if you want to move a ship through that has a capacity of a certain number of containers or a certain number of berths for a passenger ship. They charge on the basis of capacity, not in terms of the number of containers on board or the number of bodies in beds, but that eliminates the need for them to go through the cabins and count who's sleeping or feel the pillows and see if they're warm. They just charge on the basis of capacity. So pricing is one factor, and we've talked about that a little bit in these podcasts about pricing for transportation services, particularly highway services, and that moderates and demand and can shift it in time. And the other thing that the Canal Authority has done and they're doing right now is they're building a parallel set of locks. So they're moving from locks that are 110 feet wide and 1,000 feet long to locks that are 180 feet wide and 1,400 feet long so they can accommodate much larger ships. And that construction process is underway at this time.
When you say a parallel system of locks, is that essentially a second Panama Canal?
No, it's not a second Panama Canal because the bulk of the canal is a waterway that moves from the Atlantic to the or the Caribbean to the Pacific. The locks are a small part of it. They're a very important part of it, but they're the bottleneck because the rest of the canal is either Large Lake, Gatun Lake, or Pedro Miguel Lake or Miraflores Lake at the, as associated with the other locks, or the narrower channel, less than 1,000 feet wide, going through Culebra Cut. But the locks are only 110 feet wide. So what they're doing is they're building a parallel set of locks, and the main channels will continue to be used. There will be deepening, and there will be some widening, but the locks are the big construction project.
And then at 180 feet wide, will they be able to accommodate these 11,000 container ships that you mentioned?
In fact, they won't because 11,000 container ships are a little bit too big, but they will open up a much bigger market. So there's a market of what we call post-Panamax ships. Panamax is the name given to ships that are the biggest that we can move through the Panama Canal right now, and they'll be able to jump to a much larger size of ship, which accommodates a very large fraction of the biggest container ships in the market. There's still container ships that are larger, and there's certainly very large crude carriers that we won't accommodate. But from the point of view, for example, of U.S. strategic interests, the Panama Canal today cannot accommodate a Nimitz-class nuclear aircraft carrier. The new locks in the canal will accommodate that because those ships are now, they're 134 feet wide and the new locks will be 180 feet wide.
If they're going to all the trouble and expense of building these wider locks, why not make them big enough to accommodate the biggest ships on Earth?
It's a matter of trade-off, and the challenge is that you and I and all the people out there don't know how big the biggest ships on Earth are going to be. When the Panama Canal was first designed, the original plan was to make the locks, I believe, 99 feet wide. And the Navy Department contacted actually it was the War Department that was building the canal at that point in time. The Navy said, please make them wider. We envision building wider locks. And so they went to 110 feet. 110 feet in 1904, 1905 was bigger than anything anybody imagined, anything that was on the drawing boards at that point in time. So going to 180 feet puts us in the realm of much larger ships, but it's difficult to anticipate what will be in the indefinite future.
And if the new width will allow the United States to run big ships like the Nimitz through, is the U.S. therefore paying or contributing to paying for the widening of the locks?
No, it's really interesting the way this is financed. So the project, the modernization project, as they call it, the expansion project, is the estimated cost is $5.25 billion. Which in fact doesn't sound like a huge amount of money in today's market, but they've held with that cost estimate for 4 or 5 years now. That it doesn't seem to be escalating. It's being paid for by the tolls that ships pay to go through the canal. So the average toll that a ship pays to go through the Panama Canal today is about $117,000 per transit, which sounds like a lot of money, but the fact is it saves a lot of time and a lot of operating costs for a ship, which could be on the order of $8,000 to $10,000 a day. So the canal generates revenues. In fact, that's the toll revenue. The total cost for a ship to go through is considerably larger than that because the Panama Canal Authority has unbundled pricing. It's sort of like airline pricing today. You pay for the drinks, you pay for the trip, you pay for a bigger seat, and you may pay for your baggage. And in a similar way, the Canal Authority charges for the toll, they charge for tug services, they charge for inspections, a variety of other things. So the costs go considerably higher in some cases than the simple transit toll. So they've been raising the price since about 2002 in anticipation of this expansion program, and they've been socking away money to pay some of those costs. So there are sort of three sources of revenue of funds to pay for the expansion program. One is the reserves that they've set up. The other is borrowed money that they're going to pay for from future revenues, and the tolls will continue to go up, and the market knows this. They've been very clear about this. And the third is annual operating surplus. So the reserves is the annual operating surplus that they've socked away over a number of years, but they have continued to generate a surplus in part because they've raised the price.
Now, if it's $117,000 for a ship to go through and you just went on a cruise through there, that must have been a very expensive cruise.
Well, it probably was a very expensive cruise. I mean, you have to look at it from the point of view that how big is the ship, but you may be paying $100 to $200 a passenger just for the transit through the canal. On the other hand, the trip that I went on, which was a pleasure trip, wouldn't have been a very interesting trip if we didn't go through the canal. So that was really high value. If you're bringing cars built in Japan or Korea to the East Coast of the United States, and you have 1,000 or 1,500 or more vehicles on that ship, and you can save 10 or 15 days of transit time by sea, or a significant amount of money per vehicle compared to moving the product overland across the United States. The paying $125,000 or $150,000 in tolls doesn't seem like that much.
Are there any water conservation issues that are raised by the canal?
Well, it's really interesting if you look at the canal and think about the canal in cross-section, because a metaphor that I would suggest to understand how it works is it's like having a lake that's shaped like a layer cake with the highest layer in the middle, and you fill that top layer with water, and every time a ship goes through the canal from either direction, there's a unit of water that flows, which is fresh water, rainwater, that flows from the top down through the locks and out into the sea. So you're basically taking fresh water, rainwater, and flushing it into the sea with every transit, because the lock, as the ship goes through, the water is flowing from top to bottom. There are no pumps involved. It's all gravity flow. Right now, a single transit through the canal costs about 52 million gallons of fresh water. Panama's a rainforest, so didn't look like much of a problem, except that now carrying about 15,000 ships a year, it starts to be a lot of water. Some of the rainforests have been lost because they've been converted to agricultural land, and new locks are going to be bigger and will flush more fresh water into the oceans. So water conservation has become a critical issue. They've done a couple of things. They've in the expansion plans, they are going to increase the depth of Gatun Lake. That is the top level of the canal will be a couple of feet higher, which means they can store more water. So they have more water storage capacity and can handle more ships. The new locks are going to be a water saving design, which will save about 60% of the water for each transit. So instead of flushing that water through and to the ocean, as the water in the lock goes down, as the ship is being lowered, that water goes into a side basin, so you can save about 60% of it. So the new locks actually will cost less in terms of water loss to the sea than the old locks did.
Do you think with the combination of these efforts, it's a sustainable thing long-term going
forward? Well, the studies and the Panamanians have been extremely clever in doing these studies, and they've relied on the best technical resources around the world through the use of consultants. The indications are that all these actions together will give them plenty of water to do this job for the foreseeable future.
It sounds like the way you've described it throughout its history, that it's been a pretty successful infrastructure project.
It's been hugely successful, and it strikes me one of the things to learn from it is that the United States until the end of the 1990s and the Panamanians since have done a superb job in investing and reinvesting to maintain the quality of the condition, to maintain the state of the art of the equipment, so that it functions better now than it did when it was originally built. It's in extremely good condition. I mean, it's a surprise, I think, to everyone who sees it for the first time that it's 100 years old and it looks the way it looks. And what it says is, well, if you spend the resources thoughtfully, you can make infrastructure last a long time and be functional for a very long time.
And you've been there several times. We're just there recently. Was there anything you discovered or found out about on this trip that you didn't already know?
Well, what was new for me in this trip was that the expansion plan was underway. So it was possible to see the construction, saw it from the ship and not from on the ground, but to see the construction underway. And I looked carefully at the history of the canal and the equipment and the technology that was used by the Americans between 1904 and 1914 to build this canal. And it's very impressive. You look at the history that one of the keys to success of the Americans was that the Americans used construction technology that was much bigger and more robust than what the French were trying to use. The scale was much larger. The problem was large. You needed a large scale. When you look at what's going on now, the technology is radically different, but the scale is, again, much larger. So it's possible to transit the canal on a ship and see little construction trucks working on the side. And then it's something that I know a little bit about. So look at the trucks closely, or you look at them through binoculars or take a telephoto picture of them, and you realize that little truck that you see over there has a capacity of 100 tons of earth. The shovel that you see working there has a capacity of 30 cubic yards per bite. The largest shovel that was used by the United States, which was the largest shovel available at the time, had a bite of 5 cubic yards. So seeing that even from a distance and realizing how construction technologies have changed and how what was a huge problem 100 years ago is a very manageable problem today, very interesting and very educational.
What's the projected date for completion?
Projected date for completion is 2014, which is 100 years after the opening of the original canal. And evidence that what's in the literature and in the news and observations on site should suggest they're on schedule.
And finally, just because you were just there, what's the land like as you're going through that? Is it a beautiful setting?
It's a rainforest. It's a rainforest. Yes, it's a beautiful setting. It's the place where you might want to go to make a jungle movie.
So when you're going through, because I'm picturing it without any knowledge of it, I'm picturing something very concrete and industrial looking, but it doesn't feel that way.
The locks are very concrete and industrial looking, although there's an awful lot of green grass around the locks as well. But as soon as you get out of the locks, you're in a beautiful lake, an idyllic, calm lake, and the land around is green, it's trees, it's tropical. There's certainly signs of civilization alongside, but it's not built up by any means.
Did you see any monkeys?
I didn't see any monkeys, and then this time I didn't see any alligators either.
But you have in the past.
I have in the past.
Yeah. Well, Professor Schoffer, thank you so much for sharing your experience in the Panama Canal and learned a lot about it.
I hope you'll come with us next time.
Thank you.